Welcome to Vital Voices. Today, we bring you an interview with Taylor Branch. He's the author of a Pulitzer Prize-winning trilogy on the life of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. and the history of the American Civil Rights Movement. Taylor Branch was the featured speaker at the annual Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Prayer Breakfast held earlier this month in Johnson City, Tennessee. He is interviewed here by Dr. Daryl Carter, a professor of history at East Tennessee State University.
Taylor Branch is a distinguished author and historian and journalist and writer and public intellectual. He has been active as a writer since the 60s and 70s. He is originally from Atlanta. He's been involved in civil rights work himself. He graduated from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and received his master's degree from the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. He's a recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship and a National Humanities Medal and the Pulitzer Prize. Taylor, can you talk a little bit about what was Atlanta in the Jim Crow era? I think most of us have been to Atlanta. It's this cosmopolitan city. It's got all this stuff. There's CNN, there's big Fortune 500 companies, millions of people, but it wasn't that way during his childhood and early life. Can you describe what Jim Crow looked like down there?
My dad said Atlanta became a boon town as soon as I left to go to college. But when I was there, it was a small town. My dad was a dry cleaner. The first black people that I met were his employees, one of whom, his chief cleaner, Peter Mitchell, would arrive every morning looking like he was going to the Queen's wedding in a three-piece suit with a vest. He said it was the only safe way to get across the city of Atlanta at 6 o'clock in the morning. And then he would change into his smock and clean. I was a young person in the 50s working in my dad's cleaners when the demonstration started. And they scared everybody. They scared people black and white. The Klan would march. The first time I ever saw the Klan in person was in Maryland, but I saw the Klan on TV a lot. They bombed the Jewish temple when I was 11 years old. They constantly attacked, even before the sit-ins started. Sit-ins, of course, started in 1960, and the fear ratcheted up. What I remember, the mayor of Atlanta adopted the motto of Atlanta, which it still has, in reaction to the fear of the sit-ins. He said, "Atlanta is the city too busy to hate." And my sarcastic young teenage friends and I went to our teachers and said, "Our civic motto is that we have to stay busy in order not to hate, because that's our natural inclination. And that's our motto, and we're bragging about it." What a weird town this is. And you started realizing that these issues went very deep. And not to be too, I don't want to take this lightly, but as I started wondering what is going on with this as a teenager, you're trying to formulate how you fit into the world. And this world has fear in it, and it has pretense in it. At the same time, I realized that my friends and I, all the music that we listened to was Ray Charles, Jackie Wilson, the Drifters, the Tams, the Temptations. And that the very people that I knew who were most hostile to black people would sneak out to Herndon Stadium to hear Ray Charles or Hank Ballard and the Midnighters, a lot of these people you've never heard of. Why do we as white people treasure the music of black people? I mean, if you were kissing your date at the end of the date, you were listening to Johnny Mathis. You know? So why is it that when there's no vision and we're just hearing, we're deeply involved, that black people have the keys to the human heart, and yet we can't get together downtown without there being violence, and our mayor is assuring us that we're too busy to hate? Those questions went really, really deep for me in a small town. I said last night that by the time I got to be a junior in high school, I told my mother that when I got really old, like maybe 30 years old, I was going to do something about this race relations. And it seemed like about 3 days later, we saw the photographs of the children's marches in Birmingham, where 6, 7, 8-year-old girls were marching into jail, which I talked last night saying that's the turning point of race relations in the United States, owes to those kids. Dr. King couldn't get more than 10 adults after a long campaign in Birmingham, but the floodgates opened when they allowed teenagers and even small children to go to jail. It is not part of our history because it's too embarrassing for historians to admit that it took the witness of school children. It's almost like Passover, you know, nowhere in history has a great nation's politics turned on the witness of school children other than there. So anyway, that's Atlanta back then. It was so, I'm sorry to say, my mom's still there in the house I grew up in. She's almost 102. She has 27 great-grandchildren. But I had to leave Atlanta. The layers of self-deception that were going on were so strong for me that I moved away, and I still got a lot of family there, and I go, and I went to my school yesterday, driving my mother around, because the only thing she really likes to do is, she has an amazing long-term memory. She can remember what happened at every block you go past. And I went to my school, and I got lost on my own campus. It's been so overgrown, it looks like a college, and it has one-way streets and everything on a high school campus. So the town has been overrun, but it still has the same motto, Atlanta, the city too busy to hate.
Was it a foregone conclusion that he would become a minister himself? How did that develop? His father was a minister, yes?
His father and his grandfather were ministers. It was not a foregone conclusion. What was foregone is that he was going to wrestle with it. Dr. King famously said that the cultural relations of the professions were upside down between black and white when he was growing up. He said, if you were a white person and you were an idealist, you became a minister to bring love to the world. And you became a lawyer to make money. But if you were a black person and you were devoted to civil rights and helping your people, you became a lawyer. And if you wanted to make money, you became a preacher. And one of his famous sermons was about how too many of our black preachers measure their congregation by the wheelbase of their Cadillac. And he wrestled with that because there was, you know, the preacher was the center of black culture and even black economy. And in those days, because black-owned institutions didn't exist and you weren't in the news and you weren't on the radio and everything, the church was everything. It was your Congress. It was your communications. It was your entertainment. And the minister was the leader of that. Dr. King wrestled with whether he wanted to become a preacher. There was a time when he was young that he wanted to be a lawyer because lawyers were the ones that were suing. They were bringing the civil rights cases, and they were the idealists for the community. But the tradition went too deep with him. He was a rebel against a lot of the gospel for a time, but finally came to peace with it, to believe that a true minister in the spirit of equal souls in the world could be a leader too. And he reconciled himself to it in an academic way. You know, he got a seminary degree and then a PhD at Boston. So he was destined to become a minister, but he resisted it for a while until he reconciled himself and said, there's a pathway to justice through the pulpit.
And you just mentioned that King went to seminary and to Boston University, where he received a PhD. He also is getting acquainted with other ideas from other parts of the world. For example, the freedom struggle of Gandhi in India from British colonialism. Can you talk a little bit about his exposure to that, its impact on his early thinking about the movement and about the tactics that were necessary for the movement to be successful?
This is a complicated topic, his relationship with Gandhi. He and Coretta went to India in 1959. They went there in part because they were frustrated after the bus boycott. He literally thought he could preach America out of segregation, and it didn't work. He traveled all around and could make many, many audiences rise in emotional conversion for justice, but then segregation would still be there. And he went to India because Bayard Rustin, one of his advisors, had been there a lot and said he needed to be current with the latest thinking in the Gandhi movement. Now, Gandhi had been assassinated, of course, but his disciple Nehru was prime minister, and there were prominent Gandhians all over India, and he went there. It's not an unmixed story. It's not that he went there and was converted and said Gandhianism is the path to the future. Because by the time he got there, the Gandhians had split into all kind of factions. He went to see Vinoba Bhave, whose basic thing was not to kill insects. They were had all kind of strange dietary things, and he said, "We're never going to have a hunger strike for justice in America because black people like their barbecue too much, and they're not going to have these hunger strikes." And of course, Nehru was building the atomic bomb after going to jail with Gandhi. So what he got out of the trip to India and meeting with Gandhians and reading more about Gandhi, of course he had read him even as a student before, was the unflinching honesty of Gandhi in the works that he had and in his most devoted disciples, because Gandhi said the behavior of the British colonialists toward the native Indians was not totally different from the behavior of Indians toward lower caste Indians, to their own internal blindness and their own internal cruelties. And he wrote about that with a sense of confessional honesty that Dr. King said was key to what the African American movement needed to do to have the discipline to confront the injustices of segregation and white history, while trying still to refine their own beliefs and the way they treated one another. So he had a complex relationship with Gandhi, and I think that it served him well.
You know, this early part of his life, he meets the woman that will become his wife. Mm-hmm. And I think too often we think about King almost as a singular figure, but he's not. He's a father, he's a husband. Can you talk a little bit about his relationship with her and its impact on his work and his life?
Well, that's a controversial topic right there, because most of the men that were around Dr. King considered Coretta a nuisance. He adored her. He put her on a pedestal. She was a singer. She was glamorous. She was from rural Alabama near Selma, Marion County, Alabama. And he thought it was a miracle that somebody from as roughshod and tiny a community as County, Alabama, could have the dignity of an opera singer. Coretta was a singer. A lot of the people around her said she wasn't as good a singer as she thought she was, but she was a presence that he worshipped, and he said she's the perfect first lady. I don't know if you know. I don't know if this still exists or not, but they really did call the minister's wife was the first lady of the church, and they treated her like that. And Coretta was a regal figure. She didn't have the sense of humor and the risque sense that the rest of the people did, but she was she was more involved in the philosophy of nonviolence than he was starting out, which was why she became a leader in the peace movement in Vietnam before he was. Before he dared to speak out, she was doing it. So It's a complex relationship of respect and kind of worship. The people around Dr. King thought she was too remote, that she was not somebody that you would want to have a beer with and laugh. She was a formal. She had a formal nature, and so it's like everything else. You want to idealize it and say it was perfect in every respect, and they were well suited. They complemented one another, and she performed that role in the church, and then later more or less succeeded him in a leadership role in Black politics for the rest of her life.
So at this time in the early 50s, and he's getting married, he's beginning his ministry. What is his relationship with Daddy King as he becomes increasingly known for his work? Is he supportive? Is he cautioning him? What is the relationship there between the two men as his career in the movement really starts to take off in the middle part of the decade?
Well, Daddy King was a towering figure, and Dr. King was often frightened of him. He was a big, blustery guy who believed that Dr. King's role was to master his church the way Daddy King had mastered Ebenezer. And he was constantly telling him not to be involved in the civil rights movement because he was risking what he was building in the church. When Dr. King's home was bombed during the bus boycott, Daddy King showed up the next day and ordered Dr. King to get on his knees so he could pray over him. And he prayed over him saying, "Lord, help him to see that this is not the path for him and that he should get back in his church." Dr. King, part of his leadership in a very, very private and pained way, was defying his father.
You've been listening to an interview with Taylor Branch, a Pulitzer Prize-winning chronicler of the American Civil Rights Movement. Taylor Branch was interviewed by Dr. Daryl Carter, a history professor at ETSU, during the annual Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Prayer Breakfast in Johnson City, Tennessee. I'm Fred Sausman.